Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
We are proud to have back with us Benjamin Percy. Benjamin was here a couple of years ago with his novel Red Moon. He's a contributing editor for Esquire, where his work's been published. You can also see his work in GQ, Time, McSweeney's, Paris Review, and hear some of his stories on NPR. In addition, he writes for the Green Arrow series for Detective Comics. So, you know, he's got a few things going on. We are happy to have him back here with us tonight for his new book, The Deadlands. So if you would just join me in welcoming Benjamin Percy.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for coming out. So I was walking around downtown St. Louis yesterday, and beneath the arch, I felt a little unsettled because it hadn't collapsed in the center. It wasn't like a set of ragged mandibles, as I describe it in the novel. And the downtown wasn't fortified by a perimeter of stacked, rusted, mortared vehicles. There was no superflu on the loose. Pre-apocalyptic St. Louis is just not as appealing to me. So I wanted to introduce you right away to what my vision of a destroyed St. Louis and a destroyed America looks like. This is told through the perspective of a robotic owl that I'm basically ripping off from Clash of the Titans. Lewis is an inventor. He's the solitary, studious type, as he was in life. But I sort of bend things. I bend much of history in this book into this revisionary future, and I've bent him into a kind of mage. There's a bit of magic at work here. The bird perches on the wall. It observes the prisoner hauled away, the crowd scattering, and then, with a creaking snap of its wings, it takes flight. It appears to be an owl, though not like any other in the world, made of metal and only a little larger than a man's fist. Torches flare up all around the sanctuary, which is how I refer to St. Louis, to fight the intruding night, and the owl's bronze feathers catch the light brightly when it flies from the wall, then over the gardens, the stables, the ropes of smoke that rise from chimneys and forges and ovens, the twisting streets busy with carts and dogs and bodies that stumble out of doorways. The wind blows cinders and dried bits of grass up into dust devils, and the owl blasts through them. The skyscrapers and high-rises needle upward from the center of the sanctuary. Old Town, they call it, and the mechanical owl darts between the canyons of them now. Some of them still have windows, but most are open air so that they appear like a vast and rotting honeycomb inside which people crouch like brown grubs. The owl's wings whir. Gears snap and tick beneath its breast. Within its glass eyes, an aperture contracts or expands depending on whether the owl casts its gaze at light or shadow. The remains of downtown St. Louis have been built over and repurposed to the degree that someone who stepped across the centuries would not recognize one for the other. Everything sunken and leaning and crumbling and patched together in a way that appears accidental. The city covered with a dusty skin and seeming in this way, and many others, a dying thing, its windows and archways hollowed eyes, its streets curving yellowed arteries, its buildings haggard bones with its footsteps and hammer strokes, and slammed doors like the beating of an arrhythmic heart, and the many swarming bodies like black mites feeding on whatever might be scrapped, salvaged. Turbans spike the tops of many buildings. They are made from the rescued metal, and they creak and groan and spin rustily in the wind that never stops blowing. They feed into unreliable wiring that snakes through some of the buildings so that the lights sputter on and off, and empty sockets burn red and sometimes flare into fires, and the lives of the people here are energized in a similar manner, frayed and sizzling, capable at any moment of burning out. The signs are still there for Supercuts, Subway, McDonald's, Curves, Chili's, Chipotle. Though they are hard to spot, their colored plastic fractured and lichen-spotted and dulled to the yellowy shade of an old man's teeth. What was once a sandwich shop is now a blacksmith and welding studio. From its doorway steps a man who holds a clamp that grips a red-hot square of metal, maybe a door hinge or a hoe blade, and he dunks it into the bucket of horse piss and follows the steam trailing upward, and through it sees the owl blur overhead like a comet. What was once a salon is now a dentist's office. In the corner, a dryer chair sits like a dead astronaut. The studs grimace through the places where the drywall has rotted away. Near the open window, a dentist peers into a mouthful of butter-colored teeth, one of them black, and just when he secures it with his pliers, the owl flashes past his shop, and he startles backward with a tooth uprooted and his patient screaming in his chair. On a balcony, an old woman lounges in a threadbare lawn chair that nearly sinks her bottom to the ground. She wears stockings that are wrinkled at the knees and rotted through to reveal her bony ankles. Her feet are stuffed into an ancient pair of laceless Nikes, the soles as hard as concrete. She drinks foul tea from a dented thermos. Above her hangs a wind chime of old cell phones that clatter in the breeze. And when the owl buzzes by her, she shrieks, and the thermos falls 30 feet before clanging and splattering the street below. She knows whom the owl belongs to. They all know, and they fear it as they fear him. The museum, once City Hall, is one of the grandest buildings in the sanctuary, 6 stories high, with a vaulted red slate roof and marble floors and walls made of sandstone. It has the dark-windowed, stained stone grandeur of a haunted mansion. Swallows squawk and scatter where they appear as scratches against the purple-black expanse of sky, and the owl skitters to a stop on one of the upper window sills. It approaches the glass pane and taps its beak. In the street below, a few people pause to point at and whisper about the owl. Magic, some say. Freak, others say. So that gives you a glimpse of what St. Louis has become. I'm afraid Denver does not fare better. It is now a goblin city infected by radiation, where people with teeth barnacled on their shoulders and cysts dangling off of them and speaking in sort of a guttural language wander about. So this is the fate that awaits you. So our obsession with apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic, I have notes because, book tour just started, and I used to have my werewolf shtick, and I had it down. It was like a well-oiled machine, my werewolf shtick, but now I've got the post-apocalyptic shtick, still working on it. So our obsession with apocalyptic, with post-apocalyptic narratives has not ebbed. If anything, it seems to grow stronger and more severe by the year, and I will happily ride that wave. But that is not why I wrote this book. I think it has something to do with the fact that my life growing up was, maybe can only be described as pre-apocalyptic. My parents were back to the Landers for a while. And so all of the meat that I ate was harvested by my father. So elk, venison, bear, that's why I sound like this. I grew up eating bear. We grew our own vegetables, we had fruit trees, chicken coop, our own cow, and every vacation, I'm not exaggerating when I say this, every single vacation, we threw a bunch of rifles and fishing rods and pickaxes and shovels into the back of the truck, and we drove off to a dry canyon or a mountainside, and we would be camping, we'd be hiking, we'd be fishing, but we'd also be, digging up rocks. And illegally sometimes excavating archaeological sites. My dad is an obsessive rock hound. And to this day, every corner of his house seems to sparkle. There is no shelf that does not have a stone or you know, some treasure that he has discovered, like some, you know, petrified log or something atop it. And his prize was, it still is his prize, it's a deer skull encased in rose crystals that he found in a grotto. And he just keeps it in the middle of the dining room table as though, you know, it's like some sort of totem. but anyways, this is how I grew up. Never went to Disneyland. Never went to Cancun or Europe or anything like that. We just went out into the desert and dug stuff up. And then, you know, I went to survival camp growing up. And this is hardcore. On the first night, woke up because the kid in the bunk below me was screaming. And, you know, the light, all the flashlights go on. The counselor's like, what's going on? What's going on? And you know, we all look down, and the kid's got Black Widow spiders on him. And a chopper comes in and takes him out. The next day, some kid who was allergic to eggs ate eggs. The chopper comes in again. And clearly remember, like, all the campers in survival camp were just, we made, like, this long gauntlet, you know, and their EMTs are pushing him down, and we're all just watching him go. Takes off. And then we had to make atlatls. You know, so the spear's on a hinge. It's sort of like today the atlatl is that thing you throw tennis balls to your dog with in the park, right? We made spears, and we made our own. You know, we had a deer antler, and we chipped the obsidian and everything, and our hands were shredded, and then some kid's like, eh, and tossed it right into the leg of another kid. So, choppered out again. And then we had, we had to build shelters out of, like, dried wigs of sagebrush and branches, and it was a desert environment, so this is Central Oregon, and then a flash flood happened because a rainstorm came through. Wake up in the middle of the night in our shelters, and we're being washed away. There was no chopper for us that time. In the end, I was the only survivor. So I guess because of all this, you know, falling off the grid has never really been far from my imagination. It's always been an active part of my fantasy life. And, you know, I think about some of my favorite books from when I was a teenager, too. Swan Song and The Stand and The Journals of Lewis and Clark. My mom, if my dad is an amateur rock hound, can you be is there a professional rock hound? I should say amateur geologist. my mom is an amateur historian. She's obsessed with the Lewis and Clark Passage. Every one of those crazy vacations, weekend adventures we took, we would stop along the Oregon Trail or the Lewis and Clark Trail, and my mother would then lecture us on how it was the greatest, you know, adventure story in American history. And she was right, you know. It's our national poem, as some say, Stephen Ambrose says. And I've always wanted to write about it. Initially, I thought I was going to write about it as nonfiction. This was actually almost part of my deal for Red Moon, like when I was shopping Red Moon, my previous novel. One of the editors caught wind of this idea that I was going to recreate the Lewis and Clark Passage, and I was going to take different people from my life with me along different legs of it, and I was going to make it about modern day adventure, and I was also going to flash back to my upbringing, which was very Huck Finnish. And this editor made it sort of an illegal part of his bid on Red Moon. And my wife, who had no idea, I just forgotten to mention this to her. She's like, wait a second, what are you planning on doing? And then she's like, how long would that take? And we sat down, we figured it out, and it was probably about 4 months. And she's like, that's not happening. So I had to make some stuff up instead. So this is my Lewis and Clark Passage seen through the post-apocalyptic lens, this super flu that has come to the world, and the nuclear inoculation that follows, and the meltdowns that follow have made a husk of the world as we know it. And right now, I'll read a passage about the end, when the lights go out. No one knows where the flu came from. Some say a long black car pulled up to a gas station, and from it stepped a black-haired man in a black suit who coughed once into his fist and gripped the pump and muddied it with his phlegm. Others say that late one night, for a few minutes all over the town of Ames, Iowa, The faucets ran yellow, as yellow and as thick as melted wax, polluted by a terrorist, or maybe some parasite loosed from deep beneath the earth. And still others say a featherless crow, the size of a child, tumbled down a chimney and onto a fire that charred it into a black pile of bones and sent a disease cloud into the air all over town. One that people breathed into the pink pit of their lungs, where a burning sensation gave rise to a cough. That was how the sickness began, with a cough. A needling itch at the back of your throat that grew steadily worse until it felt like your chest was clogged with burrowing ants that you simply must expel, barking raggedly into your hands until they were spotted with blood. Accompanying this was a fever so powerful that a wet washcloth steamed when placed on your forehead, your brain cooked, your vision went red with twirling black flies along the edges, and all this time you were coughing, coughing, coughing. I should really put somebody in the audience and cue them here. Until it felt as though your guts might uproot. One day it was simply there, among the people of Ames, the virus rooting in their lungs like red-tipped mushrooms. The USDA labs are located there, level 4 security clearance, and host to every animal-borne pathogen in the world, from anthrax to bird flu to Ebola, and many speculated that it came from there, from an unwashed hand or an open laboratory window or a pricked finger. And really, this is true. The USDA labs in Ames, Iowa, right? It's level 4 security clearance. There's guys with assault rifles wandering around. And every nasty thing in the world is there. And they have this massive acreage upon which they keep, you know, bison and deer and various other animals. And they're always, like, drilling open their heads and putting strange diseases in them to see what happens. And there are all these crows that winter in Ames. Thousands of crows. It's apocalyptic. It's Hitchcockian. It's scary. And you'll see them, you know, they'll fly down, they'll land in these fields with the diseased bison. And then they get up and they fly across the street. And it's in the middle of nowhere, except for right across the street there is a daycare. And then the crows will be, you know, roosting on the teeter-totters. And I'm just imagining, you know, the transfer. That is ground zero for the apocalypse. There's going to be some zombie toddler who wanders out of there. I lived for 4 years in Ames. No, I had to get even with it for that. On average, it took people 5 days to die. During that time, their chests collapsed inward with every hitching cough, their throats rasped, their lips bruised like wilting lilies, the blood vessels in their eyes burst and they wept blood, and because they were propped up on pillows, the blood raked down their cheeks. This was October, and the leaves turned to shimmering gold and came loose from their branches and revealed the patterns of the wind, twisting and swirling along the streets, lawns, ballparks, making a clattering music. And when the wind picked up and the leaves rushed past and clung to the leg of someone's jeans like a starfish, damp and splayed, they would hurriedly wipe it away, as if anything the air carried might cause harm. When parents said, "You'll catch your death," they meant it. Grabbing their children as they raced out the door to hand them a jacket, yes, but also a surgical mask. "Stay in the yard," they said. "Don't breathe," they wanted to say. It was unsettling not trusting the air, lungs filling up like dark closets that might hide ghosts. Everyone bought masks, not just surgical masks, because the stores emptied of them almost immediately, but carpenter's masks, gas masks, even Halloween masks, anything, no matter how ineffective, to make them believe they were choking away the germs. Doctors prescribed medicine, but medicine did not help. Scientists gave the virus a name, H3L1, hell. It wasn't long before the hospitals were full, before schools closed, before the sidewalks in Ames crowded with reporters. 3 people died, and then in one night, 300. Everyone rushed to the grocery stores and pulled from the shelves cereal, pasta, granola bars, canned fruits and vegetables, bottled water, whatever would last, even after the electricity snapped off. "The worst is happening," they said. "The worst is here. So that's the way the world ends. Actually, it takes several more pages for the world to end. But you get the picture. So I grew up on genre. You know, I reference Swan Song and The Stand, and I mean, that's the tip of it. I was reading mysteries, I was reading spy thrillers, I was reading westerns. I did not read any bodice rippers, though I have picked a few up in the meantime. But horror especially gripped me in its bony fist. And it never really occurred to me that I could become a writer. It took me a long time to figure that out. I was in college, and I walked into my first creative writing workshop. And on that first day, the professor went over the syllabus, and he looked like a mannequin. He's a very well-known fiction writer. I won't name him. But he looked like a mannequin. He was hairless with a dead expression. And to me, you know, writing was vampires, dragons, robots with lasers for eyes. And I was ready to write some awesome dragon stories. And he went through that syllabus and he said, "No genre." And I put up my hand after a moment's hesitation. And he was like, "Yes." "What do you mean by no genre?" And he said, "No vampires, no dragons, no robots for lasers with eyes." I sat there for a minute before I threw up my hand and asked very earnestly, "But what else is there? What else is there, truly?" And thereafter, I fell in love with all of these literary writers who have populated my own syllabi. I had no idea who Raymond Carver was. I had no idea who Flannery O'Connor was. I had no idea who Tim O'Brien was or Alice Munro. And I loved their work. But I never fell out of love with genre. And I read this book called Thrilling Tales when I was in grad school, and it just kind of made my head crack open. I was so in love with the idea. Michael Chabon edited it, and he assigned to all of these different writers the kind of story they would have loved growing up. And I'd kind of forgotten about that love. You know, I was in all these classes, and my wife, who she'd be picking up the books I read, I'm like, "You got to read this." You know, I'd hand her like The Watch by Rick Bass or something like that, and she'd open it up, and it'd be like covered in notes. She's like, "You make reading not fun." And there's something to be said about that. But the idea of, like, these writers are writing stories that were fun. Most people pick up books because they want to know what happens next. And I totally lost that. Lost that pleasure. I wanted to know what was under the hood. That became my mindset. Because that analysis was such a severe part of my life when I was in all these workshops. And then here are all these writers, like Rick Moody wrote a story about a dystopian future where drugs help you relive your favorite memories. And Jim Shepard wrote a story about a giant shark. And Sherman Alexie wrote a story about zombie Indians. I was like, "This is awesome." And the sentences, too. The sentences were really pretty. You know, I guess that kind of became my aesthetic. You know, pretty sentences about exploding helicopters. Like, that's my ideal. The idea that, like, you can be artful and at the same time you can be propulsive. So I guess, like, the Margaret Atwoods of the world, the Cormac McCarthys. Like, where does Cormac McCarthy belong in this bookstore? You've got, like, No Country for Old Men in Crime, maybe? All the Pretty Horses or The Crossing in Western. Child of God might be one of the greatest horror novels ever written. The Road maybe in sci-fi. There probably is actually a section now in post-apocalyptic literature, isn't it? And then Suttree, literature. It all started to feel like, you know, those... There's such an obsession with taxonomy, like with figuring out what something is called and why it is that thing. That's the reason AWP, everybody know here know about AWP, like that's the reason AWP exists. It's just people debating what something is and why it is what it is. And I feel like they're all, it's just phantom barricades, you know? So that's sort of like the ghost lands, I guess, that I inhabit now. Is trying to be artful, trying to create a compulsive reading experience at the same time. So here's one of the things that I do when I'm strategizing. I've got this idea room, and it, appropriately enough, is a dark room. The previous owner of my house was a hobby photographer, and right off of my office is this closet that he uses as a dark room. And this is where I tack up all of my ideas. So I've got articles there, I've got images there, I've got scrolls there, and I rip off like a 10-foot scroll from my kids, Melissa and Doug Artiesel, and I tack it up, and I think about a novel for like a year before I actually write it. And I do that because I've seen... You know, I've done this myself, and I see it happen all the time to students I've taught. Like, you get this, what you think is a great idea, and you start writing it, and then it just turns to dust in your hands. And, you know, it's just like any relationship. You know, you don't just pop the question after a one-night stand. You know, you want to, like, make sure you're committed. So, you know, I tack it up for about a year, and I start in the left-hand column. I create the characters, like these Wikipedia entries. Sometimes I even draw them, cartoon them. And once I figure out who they are, then I figure out what they want. And when I figure out what they want, what they desire, I start to put, like, a cruel god obstacles in the way of that desire. And that's when I've got the first stirrings of plot. And so I've got these different, you know, these strands going across. And once I figure out the strands, I try to figure out the ups and the downs, like the rhythm of suspense. I always say, you know, as I do these upticks and downticks, moments of repose or moments of high action, I always say, like, you want, if you do the cardiogram, if you do the suspensometer, you know, if you apply that to the outline of your novel, you want it to look like Colorado, not Iowa, right? Jagged peaks and such. So yeah, one of the things when I was strategizing the structure of this novel, I really love fishbowl scenarios. Fishbowl scenarios where, like, Stephen King is really good at fishbowl scenarios. He has a lot of stories that are fishbowl. Like Under the Dome, most obviously. The Langoliers, Green Mile, Shawshank Redemption, The Mist. So in Under the Dome, an invisible dome appears over a town one day. In The Mist, a supernatural mist surrounds this grocery store and basically, I think, it encases the world and creatures start to come out of it. You know, in Shawshank or in Green Mile, you've got a key turning in a lock and a cage trapping these characters. And it creates this focused environment, this pressure cooker environment. And it becomes like a larger social experiment as a result of that, where certain emotions are exacerbated. Everything from lust to rage to courage to religious fanaticism. So I've always loved that. To give you a more literary example, Lauren Groff does a really amazing job of that in her book Delicate Edible Birds, and in the story Delicate Edible Birds, the title story. Much of it takes place in this barn. Anyways, so the fishbowl thing I wanted to do, but this is a quest story, right? I love quest stories. And I'm talking about everything from Lord of the Rings, and I'm such a nerd that even my phone wrap is a map of Middle Earth. I can speak a little Elven, you know, and Klingon, just to go cross-genre for a moment. And, you know, Lord of the Rings, The Road, the Dark Tower series. But the problem with fishbowl narratives is that you can't go on very long with them because it gets old, being trapped in one place. The problem with quest stories I've discovered is that they're episodic so often. So, like, if you look at Huck Finn, or if you look at The Road, if you look at Heart of Darkness, here's what happens. Like, Huck and Jim go down the river. They get off the raft. They have an adventure. They get back on the raft. They go down the river. They get off the raft. Hijinks ensue. They get back on the raft. They go down the river. And it's like there's no causality. There's not momentum. The same thing happens in Heart of Darkness. Down the river. Off the boat. And so what I wanted to do is, like, I thought by combining those two narratives, the story departs St. Louis, the gateway to the West, but it keeps going back to St. Louis. Like, there's a fishbowl environment there with its own story that continues. And then you have the quest narrative of the expedition. So what I do is I slash back and forth between the two. And I'm always doing that at a really annoying point. Right when there's some sort of moment of physical or emotional peril. I'm like, meanwhile, back at the sanctuary. Right, and I learned that from Law and Order. dun dun. It's the commercial break. But that's another thing that I was, and I'm really, this is why my wife says, like, I take the fun out of reading. Because every book that I read, I am just like, some, if I really respect it, I read it two or three times and map it out and draw all over it to figure out how it works. And I do that with, like, Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, which I did not think was great in terms of its writing. But it was obviously great in terms of it becoming incredibly addictive, a great storytelling experience. It was actually in Denver that I first realized I wanted to study the book, because you can't do this anymore, but it used to be you walk through airports and you knew what everybody was reading. Everybody's got their Kindle or their tablet, and I have no idea. I guess it's because they're all reading 50 Shades of Grey and they don't want you to know it. Right? It's like the paper bag over the liquor bottle. But I was walking through the Denver airport, and it looked like it was smeared in highlighter yellow. Every single gate, there were like 10 people reading Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And so I got the book, and I read it once, and I was like, why is there a 70 pages of economics at the end? Have you read the book? There's like a 70-page conversation about economics. I was like, I really am not sure about this, but I pressed on, and then it got good. I'm pretty sure it was published after he died, so maybe that it didn't get edited out. Anyways, I went through that book, and what I started to realize was, like, okay, here's Blomqvist, this embattled reporter, and he's got this problem and this problem and this problem. One's related to his job, one's related to his marriage, one's related to this affair he's having with this woman, one's related to, you know, the murderer on the island, and then you have Elizabeth Salander, and she has this trouble, and this trouble. And when I started to call these things, and I was even using different colored sticky notes for each of these, I started to call them flaming chainsaws. And I feel like that's the key to writing, you know, to making great serial television, and to making a novel really be a propulsive reading experience, is you have to have these chainsaws, these flaming chainsaws that you juggle. And I feel like right when you get that flaming chainsaw right in front of people and they're like, ah, what's going to happen? Then you cut away. And then you have the next chapter. And that's the other thing I did, is I jumped from point of view to point of view. And so you're in somebody else's point of view and you're like, but what about the flaming chainsaw? But then here's another flaming chainsaw. And you're like, but, and then, you know, it just is ever-ending cycle, and it grows more and more perilous as time goes by. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about when I'm writing. And Some literary writers hate that I do this. I know that. Like, the idea of outlining drives them nuts. So my apologies. But I'm going to read you, it's just this final entry, one of those, I guess you could say, summit moments, like one of those peaked moments, one of those set piece moments. You know, I strategize where I put these, because I want those. You don't want like a valley. You also don't want a peak, one after the other. You want that variation, that modulation, that the art of the reversal all throughout. But I open up with a peak. A big flaming chainsaw. So this is, on a cold winter night, a savior is born. Sacagawea. You know, she's really the savior of she's the true hero of the Lewis and Clark adventure. In actuality and in this book. You know, they were just a couple of lost white guys. So I make sure I give her due. It's kind of a birth of the Magi moment. She knows there is something wrong with the baby. She has known from the very beginning. First, there was the nausea that left her bedridden for weeks, dizzy and barely able to eat, chewing on cucumbers, filling up on spring water. Then the surges in temper, the blackening headaches, and finally a stillness inside her when there should have been movement, a fluttering like the tail of a trout. That's what her friends told her, so that she would twist her body and prod her belly until the child readjusted itself, assuring her that it was there, it was alive. They live in a windowless cabin high in the mountains. Others live not far away, some near a spring-fed stream. Others cut back in the woods, and together they form a village of sorts, happily isolated, wary of outsiders and change, and fearful of the stories told by their elders, stories of an illness that causes a bloody cough and blistering fevers, stories of missiles raining from the sky and cratering the earth, stories of scavengers with meaty breath and teeth filed into points. Outside, the snow is knee-deep. Before long, it will be taller than her husband, taller than the cabin, and every day they will need to shovel a wide passage from their door in case they should be trapped, shrouded. Sometimes she dreams the child is not a child. It is a grub, fat and white and segmented, with black eyes. It is a beast with tiny yellow fangs and tiny yellow claws, its body covered in fur as sleek as an otter's. Or maybe it is a nothing, a dark spirit, a possessed vapor, and her body the house it haunts. So she is relieved when she gives the final push and feels a tear, a gush, an emptying, and then the midwife smiles and coos and says, "There now." She cuts the cord with a knife. She carries the child to the table and wipes it clean with a rag. Juliana bunches towels between her legs and watches the child through heavy-lidded eyes. Everything is fine. Everything will turn out all right after all. She is, as her mother always said, a worrier. And then she notices something. The absence of something. The baby is not crying. The baby has not made a sound. The midwife stands over it, the red rag in her hand like a crushed rose. "What's the matter? Is it alive? It's alive, isn't it?" The midwife nods. "Is it all right?" The midwife looks at her, looks at the baby, with a mouth that quivers with words she cannot express. "What is it? A boy?" "A girl." "What's wrong?" Her voice comes out a choked whisper when she says, "Her eyes." She drapes a blanket around the child and hurries to the bed in a rush to be rid of it. Juliana accepts the child and tears away the wrappings. Her face, splotchy and wrinkled and coned from birth, looks like any baby's face, but her eyes, they are wide open, seemingly lidless, with no whiteness to them, all pupil, no iris as if splashed full of ink. The midwife says they will worry about it later. For now, the child must eat. The midwife thumbs down the baby's chin and plays its mouth along her nipple while Juliana massages her breast and brings from it a thick, yellowish bead of colostrum. The baby nods toward the taste but will not latch on. She keeps pulling away to stare at Juliana. It may be a trick of the light, the cabin so dim, but the baby's large eyes appear somehow sorrowful. Juliana struggles to hold the baby's head in place. She does not believe the baby should be strong enough to do so, but she is, arching her back and twisting her head to study Juliana's face. Robert cannot take the sound of her screams, or the sight of his wife writhing naked in pain. He tries to help at first, packing snowballs to rub along her wrists and ankles and forehead, but he cannot stop staring at her belly, which seems somehow separate from her, the skin so tight it appears ready to split, almost purple in color, with a white line running down its middle. He thinks he sees shapes in it, what look like hands, a face pressing against the skin, the baby trying to claw or chew its way out. So he pulls on his boots and doeskin jacket and escapes outside. Snow falls and accumulates on his shoulders when he paces. He is a simple man who pleasures in small things. The song of a nuthatch, the last flare of sunlight on the horizon before night rushes in, the taste of rare lamb and oak-aged whiskey. His wife confuses him. She is a woman of many moods, rarely steady in her feeling, weeping when she says she loves him and draws him into a hug, weeping when she she laments him and hurls a dish at the wall. He has learned when her anger spikes not to say anything. Not saying anything is the best medicine for their marriage and making himself scarce. After one of her spells, that's what she calls them, as if they were dark magic. He might chop wood or weed the garden or wander around the bend to his nearest neighbor, Coulson, for a game of cards or dice. He hears now another cry from inside, the loudest yet and the worst sound imaginable, like an animal dying, falling from a cliff or rent in half by an axe, and he can only hope that the baby is here, that this is the end. The snow is thick and his mind distracted, so he does not look east, where through the falling snow he might notice a faint orange glow, his neighbor's cabin burning. And when he paces, the snow creaks beneath his boots, so he does not hear the hushed passage of the two men clambering up the hill toward him. They appear as beasts, robed in bearskins, the hollowed heads of which rest atop their own, the snouts like toothed visors that throw a shadow over their faces. They run a few paces, their boots splashing up snow, and then crouch down, run and then crouch, and in this way they progress up the hillside, threading through trees, trampling icy bushes, plunging over frosted logs. Then they duck down and scuttle close and lift their heads slowly over a lip of snow to observe him pacing and muttering, and then, with a white sparkling explosion, they rush forward. When the door first crashes inward, Juliana is fatigued enough by the labor and distracted enough by the child that she does not scream. She only thinks, how strange, a bear. Hurrying out of the night and into the cabin, shaggy and caked with snow and thudding across the floorboards. It pauses near the fire, the snow melting in the heat, streaming off its fur, and only then does she see the bearded man beneath the skins, the light brightening his eyes into orange coals. In one hand he grips a knife. Its metal is bloodied, a red patina with ice crystals flowering from it. The midwife edges her way along the far wall and tries to dart past him, and he lets her. But just before she reaches the doorway, another bear-suited man steps through and seizes her and drags her into the night, her screams muffled by the snow. The first man starts toward Juliana. She is naked. She is physically ruined. She is beyond exhausted after 8 hours of contractions, 2 hours of hard labor. But still, she tries to fight. She nestles the baby into a blanket on the bed and then lurches her body to the edge of the mattress, reaching for the rifle her husband keeps there. The man dulls her with a fist to the temple. A momentary hush falls over the world, and her vision narrows. She notices the lantern flickering on her night table. She notices a knot like an eye peering down from one of the ceiling's crossbeams. She notices the skis and poles hanging from the wall, the wedding afghan her Oma knitted draped over a rocking chair. And then the world widens and comes crashing into motion again, and she realizes she is no longer in her bed. The man is dragging her across the floor, toward the door, his hand a crushing manacle around her wrist. She cannot walk, though she tries. Her legs stumble and collapse beneath her. Her knees thud the grooves, her feet needle with splinters. Her belly feels carved out by a hot spoon, but the anger boiling inside her gives her strength. She cries out and throws back her body, battling his grip. He strikes her again, knocking the last bit of willfulness from her body, and then mummies her in a blanket and hefts her over his shoulder. She does not scream. My baby, though she knows she ought to. She only looks back to the bed, where the child lies in a nest of blankets stained with blood and embryonic fluid, watching her curiously with eyes as black as the night that soon envelops her. Thanks. Just so you know, they both turn out okay. So I am happy to take any questions you might hurl my way now, should you have them. Yes, sir.
I've got one. So your writing is very beautiful, yes. Especially the owl passage, the first one. How much of that comes out like that, the first draft, and how much of that is like edited in later? It's just mesmerizing.
So I have to repeat the question for the sake of the podcast in brief, and that is pretty sentences, how I cobble them together. And some of them are less than pretty, I must say. And even when up here, I am editing myself. I skipped several sentences, cut out several adjectives. I guess that's a good thing that I'm hopefully becoming less and less sucky. That's what that means, right? I haven't plateaued. So, I don't know. Part of it comes in flow. Like, you know the best, you've done the best writing when, like, a few hours pass and there's 10 pages in front of you and you aren't quite sure where that came from. Like, when you get in that it place, when you get in that zone, you tap into the ether. Those moments are rare. But sometimes, like, you just have that song. It feels like it was already inside of you. Sometimes that happens. More often, you know, it's a stilted, slow process. And then I go back and I read it aloud. Like, reading something aloud, that really helps. Like, if it feels unnatural on your tongue, as some of the sentences do when I'm reading them now, you know that the beats are off. You know, there are too many adjectives. You know, you shouldn't have used that at adverb. Instead, you should have used an adverbial phrase. You know, like, I think I had a irritatedly or something in here. I sort of said with irritation. It would have sounded so much better. Anyways, I edit every day when I sit down. That's how I start my day. I sit down and I read what I wrote the day before. And if it's a novel, I'm usually reading from the beginning of a chapter forward. If I'm writing a short story, it's from the very beginning forward. And what happens is, by going over it and by going over it and by going over it, it's like a stone turned over in a river. This eventual polish that occurs. Some people prefer just to like vomit it all up and then go back, and that's not my style. I feel like I find that flow again. I find the voice again by beginning each day in editorial mode and then eventually making my way to white space. Yeah, Andrew. No, I mean it. Some of these sentences really suck.
Well, you know, the last reading here for Red Moon, you said very similar things. So I'm just curious, I mean, how have you come to sort of accepting, I think I'm in the same boat with you, like, how have you come to accept that, you know, in a couple of years or right here, you're going to be dissatisfied with
right. what you put the idea of, like, how to let something go, the idea of how do you know when you're done, accepting the fact that you're never going to be up to your standards 3 months from now, 3 years from now, 3 decades from now. I don't know. I guess I'm kind of an impatient guy. I have this annoying urgency to me. Like, I can't take it easy. I don't like to stick with one project for too long. I want to move on to the next thing. And so that helps. I'm able to let things go because I want to work on some other project because I'm exhausted by this one. With that said, though, I do think that there is a dangerous honeymoon phase you go through. You know, when you first finish anything, you've got your rose-colored goggles on. You're like, this is genius. You know, you're wondering why, as you walk down the street, you know, people aren't like high-fiving you. Why your cell phone isn't buzzing with Oprah on the other end. Congratulations, you did it. And then, you know, you wait 6 weeks, you wait a few months, and you look at it again, and it's, you know, the experience is sort of like biting into a sandwich that's wrapped in tinfoil, and some of that tinfoil is still in there, you know, and you're, you cringe. The putting in the drawer idea, Stephen King prescribes it. He puts everything in a drawer for 6 weeks, he says. And then you see the warts on the face of the thing that need to be sanded off. But how long has it been since I handed in this copy edited manuscript a year, and I missed a lot. You know, it's again the marital metaphor, right? You know, as time goes on, like steadily, sometimes you grow more and more annoyed with the other or disenchanted. I should say, my marriage is awesome. I'm just talking about other people's marriages. I'm sure, I mean, when people even now, they buy like one of my short story collections. It's like, or I just Skyped into a class the other day that was talking about Refresh, Refresh, the title story of one of my collections. And, you know, that was over 10 years ago. And when I look at it now, I'm like, oh, you moron. I try not to be embarrassed by it because I know that like it's important to have that progression. But it's just like when people pick up a book and they're like, I'm going to start with this one. I'm like, well, then you'll never keep going. Start with this one, then move backwards to observe my arc from suckage to less suckage. Yeah, yeah.
So does she ever share with you what she's actually reading, or is it just a wall?
well, we have some crossover in our reading interests, but you know, I read a lot of comic books and I read a lot of scary stuff and like super genre-fied stuff that she doesn't really interested in. And she reads a lot of super touchy feely stuff that I'm not that interested in. But every now and then, yeah, we'll have like, you gotta read this, you gotta read that. Right now she's reading this book called A Little Life. And she's like, this is gonna... I've had like three people say this to me recently, by the way. I think it came out in March. And they're like, I think my life is going to change as a result of reading this book. It seems like a pretty awesome endorsement to me. I think I might pick it up before I leave the shop. Anyways, what we'll do sometimes if I have a book that she wants to read, we'll buy another copy. But I have become much better about not writing all over my books.
So you don't take her books and write all over?
No, I'm not allowed to. What I've started doing is I'm trying to turn it off. Like I'm trying to just read for pleasure. And if I'm really interested in the book, I'll go back and read it again in analytical mode. And sometimes I'll then take notes in like a yellow legal tablet, as opposed to writing my graffiti on the bathroom wall. Any other questions? Yes, sir. Mr. Gamble. Right there. I named one of my characters in Red Moon, the hero of the book, after Mr. Gamble. I had him in class at Iowa State University in Ames, which is home to the apocalypse. And on the first day of class, like, Patrick Gamble, that's a great name. I'm going to steal that. Sure enough.
Utilized in literature. So my question is, was the interview with Steve Harvey as awkward and boring as it seemed to those of you?
He's referring to an interview I did on the Today Show with Steve Harvey, who was the guest host for the day. And it was the weirdest thing because Steve Harvey's a comedian, right? And I had wrote this comedic piece about wearing a pregnancy suit. I traveled all the way to Japan to like wear this high-tech pregnancy suit, and you know, it was supposed to be a gag piece that like made fun of men and our incompetence. And so I'm like, Steve Harvey, this will be great, right? It'd be like the stand-up routine. And Steve Harvey had done no research, right? He had not read the article. He had no idea who I was. And as a result, he just thought I was like this weird earnest guy who really wanted to experience pregnancy. And so I came in there just slinging jokes left and right. And Steve Harvey, you can see it's like 30 seconds in, he has a mild stroke that he never recovers from. And so basically the entire thing is me just like riffing. And Steve Harvey having no idea what to say. At one point he even said, have you ever bitten a man? Just apropos of nothing. I thought there was a joke coming, so I was like, no. I was waiting for the punchline. There wasn't one. But the awfulness of the interview, I mean, truly, it is one of the probably the most awkward interview in television history. I feel like the awkwardness of it makes it like a comedy sketch off of Saturday Night Live or something. I think it's that much funnier as a result.
The knowing glance that you gave your readers when he asked you if you'd ever bitten anyone was...
yeah, at one point, too, I winked because he was... You know, I was like, you know, I actually didn't, I'm a novelist. I didn't actually, I don't do hard journalism. Like, I do soft journalism. And I, you know, I didn't actually wear a pregnancy suit for 9 weeks. I put it on for like 2 seconds, then I made up the rest. and so I gave, you know, I gave a knowing wink. Like, and there's like this dead space during the, which is, you're never supposed to have in TV. It's like 5 seconds of just on Steve Harvey's face. So I'm actually kind of proud of it. Just the total weirdness of it. I mean, after that, I got invited on every talk show in America. Truly. Anderson Cooper wanted me on. Jimmy Fallon wanted me on. Everybody, I was supposed to be on the Hallmark Channel wanted me on, and I was like, no, I'm not going to be the pregnancy suit guy. Chelsea Handler even featured it on her show, and they played the clip, and then they just made fun of it, and they started to make fun of me, you know, like, I didn't know the voice of the Witness Protection Program was an actual dude. So, yeah, luckily I'm not embarrassed easily. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
I recognize most of the names in the novel from history. I didn't recognize John Coulter. Is that one you made up? Or is that
No. John Coulter is one of the more famous members of the troop, actually. And Sebastian Younger wrote a really interesting essay about him called Coulter's Run. And Coulter was famously pursued naked through the snowbound wilderness by a band of natives who were, like, giving him a sporting chance, and somehow he actually escaped. And so I wanted to build off that mythology, so I do have Coulter doing a naked run. Yeah. And there's all these echoes. There's all these echoes of the actual expedition. In here, and names that you'll recognize. And Aaron Burr, for instance, he's one of the villains of the story. And Aaron Burr, in actuality, wanted to make the Louisiana Purchase. He was a strong advocate of slavery. And he wanted to make the Louisiana Purchase into a republic, a separate republic from America. So, you know, I'm playing off all these things, but nobody should go to this novel for a history lesson.
One more.
Okay, cool, yeah. You know, I've read the journals, I've read Undaunted Courage, I've read the novel that I can never remember the title of. I should be extremely glad to be in your company, I think that's it. I've seen the Ken Burns documentary, I've visited Fort Clatsop so many times that I could recite what the reenactors were saying. So, I didn't need to do any research, except on all the post-apocalyptic stuff. So, like with Red Moon, I did all sorts of research into animal-borne pathogens to try and create a physical analog to the werewolf myth to make it into a believable horror. And in the same way in here, what I try to do is create a slippery sort of science to make the apocalypse as believable as possible, to really study the effects of radiation and temperature and age on the world without us. So, will there be human-sized albino bats in the post-apocalyptic future? I hope so. But I mean, I'm obviously stretching believability to some degree, but it's grounded in research I did. Cool. Thanks so much for coming out, everybody.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.